This is Friday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up on today's program, the president of the Philippines has added to his list of controversial comments. Today, he likened himself to Adolf Hitler.
They are embarrassing for the Philippines, and of course, they are crude.
Also ahead, India sends its fighters across the Pakistan border. They did that yesterday. We'll talk about what might lie ahead in that part of the world. And in at least one city, the next pizza you order might be made and even delivered by robots. All on today's International Edition. We begin our program today talking about Rodrigo Duterte. He is the president of the Philippines, whose latest controversial comments made today. He linked himself to Nazi leader Adolf Hitler, saying he would be happy to kill 3 million drug users and criminals as one way to what he called finish the problem. Duterte, who has asked the Senate for an extension on his war on drugs, previously said human rights investigations would not stop him from continuing to crack down on addicts. Here's what he said.
Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. Now, there is 3 million, there's a 3 million drug addicts. There are.
If you're having trouble understanding that, he said Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. There are 3 million drug addicts. There are. I'd be happy to slaughter them. At least if Germany had Hitler, the Philippines would have what, you know, my victims. I would like to be all criminals to finish the problem of my country and save the next generation from perdition. That's what he said. He said critics have portrayed him as cousin of the Nazi leader. Duterte added that if Germany had Hitler, then the Philippines would have him. Reports say that since Duterte took office, more than 3,000 people have been killed by police and vigilantes for alleged drug use or peddling. We welcome to International Edition John Ciocchieri, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Professor, thanks for being with us. These latest comments are just topping the list of the many comments that Duterte has made. Some are calling embarrassing, others are calling crude. How do you term them and how dangerous are they?
I would use that latest term that you did, which is dangerous. They are embarrassing for the Philippines, and of course they are crude, but his insults against world leaders, against the entire European Union, against President Obama, and perhaps even more incisively, his threats to carry out these kinds of executions of drug users and drug dealers, poses a serious danger to human rights, to the rule of law, and even to social stability in the Philippines.
How much support does he have at home?
It's hard to gauge precisely. He certainly had very strong support at home shortly after taking office. In late July, a poll found that he had a 91% approval rating in the Philippines, but that was before a lot of the most incendiary comments that he's made, and it was also before the body count began to accumulate to the figure that you mentioned, at least 3,000 dead to date. And so I suspect that if we were to do a poll today, that his numbers would be significantly lower. That said, we have to understand in addressing the challenge that he poses that there is a significant number of people in the Philippines who believe that harsh anti-crime and anti-drug measures are necessary and therefore are going to be willing to give Duterte a pretty long leash to carry out his plans.
Well, they did elect him, did they not?
They certainly did, and his campaign pledges were discounted by many inside and outside of the country as exaggerations and as populist bluster. But I think now that he's in office, we can see that his words need to be taken quite seriously, that he's willing to actually carry out some of these plans to kill people without trial or even without what most lawyers would consider to be reasonable suspicion, and also to acquiese in a lot of extrajudicial killings by vigilantes and others who are not even wearing the uniform.
What can be done as far as trying to isolate this guy?
Well, certainly regional partners, Southeast Asian countries, members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, meet with Philippine officials at senior levels very regularly. I think that privately, if not publicly, that some of the Philippines' neighbors need to communicate to Duterte and to his colleagues that this behavior doesn't just have implications for the U.S.-Philippine relationship. It also has implications for the entire region. I suspect that a lot of Philippine officials are hearing that message. And indeed, we see a gap in a lot of cases between what Duterte says that he will do as president and then the follow-up messages by senior officials who seem to have either been unaware that he'd make certain announcements or to very much want to claw back some of his bolder pronouncements. And so probably the single most important mechanism is for members of his own cabinet and the military hierarchy to speak with the president and to try to convince him that while foreign policy reorientation is something the Philippines can certainly consider, that rash and precipitous moves in foreign policy and in domestic affairs are dangerous for the country.
Where do you see this going?
It's very difficult to predict, but I think the near term that Duterte will continue to push forward on his plans with the domestic war on drugs and probably continue to, at a minimum, ruffle a lot of feathers internationally. For a while, international partners of the Philippines can try to write this off as a new president finding his way or the hangover of a populist political campaign. But the longer he's in office and the more the body count piles up in the Philippines, the more difficult it becomes for external partners of the Philippines to continue to maintain their sort of cautious posture toward him.
John Ciocchieri is Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks so much for being with us. Joining us in studio is my colleague Andrew Palczewski, who covers social media, among maybe 2,000-3,000 other things around here at VOA. Anybody saying anything on social media about Duterte?
Yes, absolutely. And much of which we can't say on the air because it's not fit for broadcast. But the general consensus is that these comments are very disturbing and people are very concerned about what actions might follow these comments, if he's actually going to act out on these things and where the future of the Philippines is going to go under Duterte. So a lot of concern about those comments. Somebody here in the U.S. who today is making news. I think he just makes about news just about every time he tweets Donald Trump. Tweeting out about Alicia Machado, of course, this was the former Miss Universe that Hillary Clinton mentioned in her debate appearance. Donald Trump leveling some very strong claims against her about her character, about working with her, everything, including her weight. A lot of people very offended by these comments, very unhappy with these comments from Donald Trump.
Apparently, he tweeted these things like at 3 a.m.
And that's the other bizarre thing is the fact that he sent some of these tweets. You know, one was, I think, 3:15 a.m. The other one was about 5:00 a.m. So odd timing that he sent these out in the middle of the night. He says he does all the tweeting himself. So it's very odd that he sent these. But the Trump supporters are saying, well, you know, she was under a contract to be Miss Universe. She was expected to maintain a certain weight or certain appearance. They're even as going as far as saying that Hillary Clinton helped her get citizenship to use her in the debate. So the political ugliness continues on that. But since it is Friday, we like to close out on things that are a little more positive.
Please, please do that.
The Rosetta space probe crashed into a comet earlier today. Now, that would not be a positive story in any circumstance, except that the Rosetta comet, or excuse me, the Rosetta probe had been circling that comet for a number of years, a 12-year mission it was on, and this was the end of its time circling the comet. So it was actually a planned crash. But the interesting thing about this is that you could actually follow along on social media. The Rosetta actually had its own Twitter account, so it was tweeting out updates and things, so you could follow along with that, and a lot of people did. So they're sad to see
even
it go.
Even if it was three in the morning.
Even if it was 3 a.m. Any time, there is, you know, space knows no time. There's no time off for comet probes. But no, a lot of people sad to see the end of that mission, but really glad that they were able to experience it, in even if it was only virtually.
Rosetta said nothing about Miss Universe either.
I don't believe so.
That is Andrew Palczewski joining us every week at this time. In fact, almost every day at this time, and other times as well with social media. Thanks, Andrew, for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Good weekend.
You too.
Here are some of the top stories we're covering for you. U.S. President Barack Obama has strongly condemned what he called the barbarous Russian and Syrian regime airstrikes on civilians in eastern Aleppo. The Rosetta spacecraft's 12-year mission studying a comet came to an end Friday when it crash-landed on the surface as planned, snapping photos along the way and tweeting about it as well. President Barack Obama hailed Shimon Peres Friday as a man who showed the world that justice and hope are at the heart of the Zionist ideal and saw all people as deserving of dignity and respect. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte raised the rhetoric over his bloody anti-crime war to a new level Friday, comparing it to Hitler and the Holocaust, saying he would be happy to slaughter 3 million addicts. And North Korea may be building a submarine designed to launch missiles, according to a U.S. site that monitors North Korean weapons. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. This is International Edition from the Voice of America. India's army said Thursday that it had launched what it called surgical strikes against suspected militants along the border with Pakistan, but Islamabad rejected that claim, calling it an incident of cross-border firing. These strikes come in the wake of a militant attack on an Indian army base earlier this month in Kashmir that killed 18 soldiers and which Prime Minister Narendra Modi said would not go unpunished. India's Director General of Military Operations, Ranbir Singh, told a news conference Thursday that the strikes were carried out to thwart terrorist teams positioned on launch pads, is what he called them, along the disputed Kashmir border. Joining us is Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. And Michael, thanks for being with us. We know, and it's well known, the tension between India and Pakistan is decades old. But how tense is the relationship after yesterday's incursion by India?
Well, things are looking pretty bad, and we need to keep in mind that relations between these two countries were in really bad shape for a number of months before the attack on the Indian military base in Kashmir, and before this, what India describes as this surgical strike yesterday. I mean, in effect, in Pakistan, you have a military that is very anti-India and is particularly emboldened, given that it has effectively taken so much power away from the civilian government, and the government in Pakistan tends to be a bit more dovish when it comes to Pakistan, when it comes to India. And then with India, you have a conservative nationalist government that has vowed from the days it was on the campaign trail to take a tougher line on Pakistan. And so there's been a lot of pressure for the government to do something, so to speak. And I think that what we saw with this strike that it undertook yesterday is that it wanted to send a powerful message to the Indian people that it's not going to sit quietly anymore in the face of Pakistani provocations. And that's where we stand now. I mean, on both sides, you've got no incentives to try to ease up the tensions, which is pretty unsettling when you realize that both these countries have nuclear weapons.
Both sides have not backed down at all for what they've said in the past 24 to 48 hours, and as a matter of fact, have steeled their position. You think a shooting war is a possibility here?
No, I mean, here's some good news. My own sense is that there's unlikely to be a shooting war, and I say that for several reasons. One is that, what happened with this so-called surgical strike, it really wasn't as escalatory a move as a lot of the jingoistic rhetoric in India would suggest. I mean, India described this essentially as a move to take out terrorists that were planning to come into India to stage attacks. So in that sense, it was really a preemptive strike against terrorists that threatened security in India. Another thing is I imagine that Pakistan will want to be very careful about how it retaliates. It's very worried that it's losing a lot of aid and support from the U.S. government. And the U.S. government, I imagine, has been working the phones hard to push the Pakistanis to ease back and not be tempted to retaliate for this latest Indian incident. But at the end of the day, I think the big issue here is nuclear weapons. India is going to be very careful, very cautious about doing anything significant in terms of the use of military force in Pakistan, just because Pakistan has said that it would use nuclear weapons in response to conventional military action staged by India, including limited military action. Now, of course, a lot of that could be bluffing, but Pakistan has got more than 100 nuclear warheads. And it's been described as the fastest growing nuclear state in the world. So there's something to be concerned about there. So I think that for these reasons, the idea of a hot war, a shooting war, is unlikely, though that doesn't mean that we couldn't have future strikes like the one that the Indians conducted yesterday. It does not mean that we could not have additional terrorist attacks inside India that could be traced back to Pakistan. So there could be a lot of covert activities and these types of things. But I would be very surprised if we had another war between these two countries.
And what about the U.S.? Is Washington caught between the proverbial rock and a hard place?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, Washington, of course, the last thing it wants is a war on the subcontinent. I would argue that the U.S. position has evolved a bit. You know, previously when there'd be major India-Pakistan tensions, the U.S. would simply release all these statements and make these comments about how India and Pakistan need to work out their differences by dialogue. What I've noticed very strikingly over the last few weeks is that the U.S. government messaging has been very different. It's essentially been come down firmly on the side of India, in which it said that the U.S. is fully behind India in its efforts to combat cross-border terrorism and so forth and so on. So that suggests to me that the U.S. would not necessarily try to stop India from carrying out future strikes, like the one on Thursday in which it took out terrorists. I mean, the U.S. has been unable to get Pakistan to crack down on terrorists of all forms on its soil. So if India were in a position to do it through these limited tactical strikes, I don't necessarily think that the U.S. would oppose that.
Michael Kugelman is Senior Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson Center. This is VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. U.S. lawmakers say the scandal involving phony accounts at Wells Fargo Bank is bound to hurt trust in the whole financial industry. The Wells Fargo chairman and CEO, John Stumpf, faced a new round of grilling this week during a congressional hearing looking into allegations that the bank cheated customers by creating millions of phantom savings and credit accounts to meet their quotas. Despite issuing several apologies, Stumpf insists he did nothing wrong. VOA's Mil Arcega has more.
Out to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Wells Fargo Chairman and CEO John Stumpf returned to Capitol Hill Thursday for another testy exchange with lawmakers.
Congressman, I see something very different between being honest and breaking our code of ethics and taking advantage of...
You didn't break code of ethics? Would you admit this? That not only do your bank have a black eye, that your bank, Wells Fargo, has given the entire financial service industry a black eye. Your responsibility.
At issue is the bank's admission that in the past 5 years, it used confidential customer information to open as many as 2 million savings and credit card accounts without telling customers. That's called fraud, says Columbia Law School professor John Coffey.
You are making up bogus accounts and charging people for accounts they don't know they have, and you're taking money out of roughly 1.5 million accounts and putting it into new accounts.
For bank customers, it's become an issue of trust.
I feel like I need to talk to them. I want to call them to see what's been going on and how this is going to affect me.
State and federal regulators have fined Wells Fargo $185 million. But that's small potatoes, says one banking analyst.
I don't think that the issue for Wells Fargo is the fine. I think the issue for Wells Fargo is the damage to its reputation, the impact on its stock price, which was far worse than anything that the fine itself represented.
The bank has fired 5,300 employees connected to the scheme and has apologized to customers. But even after longtime CEO Stumpf forfeited $41 million in stock awards, he remains adamant he did nothing wrong.
This is International Edition. That was Mil Arceca on what is happening as far as Wells Fargo is concerned. This is International Edition. It's likely that the pizza you order in the near future from a nearby pizzeria will be prepared and baked by a robot. That's what many pizza makers, including Zoom, a new startup in Mountain View, California, are experimenting with these days. Zoom already has acquired two robots that work tirelessly, and they work for free. The company hopes to increase profits, but what about human workers? Will robots eliminate their jobs? Faiza Al-Masri investigated the story, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
This is one of two robots working for Zoom Pizza. When the pie is perfectly covered with sauce and other toppings, the robot puts it in the oven.
We spend less money on repetitive labor, so things like slicing pepperoni or applying cheese. We automate those repetitive tasks so that we can spend more money on higher quality ingredients.
Enjoy, have a great day.
Customers like it.
It's delicious. It's always hot and fresh when it comes. And I mean, it's great that they're making it, but I can't tell the difference that it's made by a robot versus a human. It's delicious.
Zoom's biggest innovation is yet to come, a delivery truck equipped with 56 ovens. At precisely 3 minutes 15 seconds before arriving at the customer's door, the pizza is popped in to bake. The company also shortens delivery times by using software to anticipate when and what kind of pizzas customers will order.
Faith Lapidus reporting about the robots and the pizza. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin. Pete Hundley handled the controls. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day and your weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his recent address to the UN General Assembly in New York, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani denounced sectarianism and attempts to promote religious divisions. Yet in Iran, persecution of minority religious communities continues, and it is a matter of deep concern to the United States, said Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein. The victims of that persecution and discrimination include Sunni Muslims and those who follow the Sufi tradition, also Zoroastrians, Jews and Christians, and dissident Shia adherents. But it is the Baha'i community, whose faith has been essentially criminalized, said Ambassador Saperstein, who suffered the severest repression.
The very existence of the group is declared to be illegal. Its leaders are in jail in many cases, and often any of those in jail often end up with facing significant human rights abuses there as well. Any of the religious activities of the Baha'is are often repressed, persecuted, subject to arrest by the government.
Not only are the Baha'is' religious activities forbidden in Iran, Baha'i businesses are subject to arbitrary closure, individuals are attacked with impunity, graveyards are despoiled, and students are refused admittance to university unless they renounce their faith. Ambassador Saperstein noted that religion is an extraordinarily powerful part of the lives of the vast majority of people on earth. It is, he added, an integral part of a person's identity.
So it goes to the core issues of the rights of someone to live in accordance with their conscience. When someone is told they can't do that and will be subject to repression or persecution or discrimination, then it divides that society along sectarian divisions. It creates different classes of citizenship.
The result, said Ambassador Saperstein, is a destabilized society where the structures that should unify a society are weakened. In contrast, even when a government has a religious identity but still protects the rights of all its people, that government nurtures a kind of trust, a comity, and a commonweal that makes a country stronger. Without religious freedom, said Ambassador Saperstein, there can be no real democracy, no stability, and no lasting security for any country. Promoting this fundamental right is indispensable to America's values and to America's interests and to the well-being of all humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.